taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Tommy, I got a bone to pick with Facebook Marketplace.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
Well, we've been looking for a C3 Corvette. You know, the one that's like the Coke bottle, the sexy one. And I've been combing through ads for it because Craigslist is kind of dying. Everything's kind of moved over to Facebook. So I've just been really having a hard time just even figuring out if the car is worth going to look at. And so I thought it'd be fun to do a podcast talking about like what not to do when you're posting a car on Facebook.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good. And also some tips that if you are trying to sell a car,
yeah, exactly,
some ways to get the most money and how to sell a car quickly.
Yeah, so let's start with my basic premise, which is people, especially with like classic cars like Corvettes, buy those cars with their heart, not with their head. And the way you get to their heart is through their eyes. And so I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make is they just don't really put a lot of time and effort, if any, into the pictures of the vehicle. So let me start with this one that I was looking at, which is the very first one here. And you can tell that is a Corvette that I can't even tell what color that is, Tommy.
Well, I think this guy's going for the barn find look. So if you're listening to the podcast, we're taking a look at a 78 Corvette that's parked in between two cars, jammed in between two cars, covered in dirt. And we can see the 78 Corvette, 25th anniversary, runs and drives, just been sitting for a little bit. A little bit is a bit of an understatement, I think, because it looks like it has about 14 inches of dust on it. Some really crazy cars in the background, though. Look at that. So clearly this is a car that's been abandoned in like a warehouse, and this guy's trying to move it on. But, oh, and it's covered in cat and raccoon paw prints,
yeah. So, look, my assumption here is driven 93,000 miles, 25th anniversary. My assumption is that whoever is selling this, if they can't even be bothered to clean the car off, then the car is probably has a lot of deferred maintenance. I mean, you know what I'm saying? If you can't even be bothered to clean it off, well, I like the interior, it's red, and pull it out and present it in such a way that makes me want to buy it. But maybe you're right. Maybe this is the barn find look. But then again, if you look, it was listed a year ago, dude. So apparently the barn find look is not working.
Yeah. And look, we see this a lot on Facebook where someone posts a car and then they don't bother changing the price. They don't bother changing the description. They don't bother changing the images. They just leave it up to fester on the vine. And then a year later, your $13,000 car is just not going to sell. So this is a good example of, yeah, just put even the smallest amount of work, rinse the car off, and take good pictures. And there's a good shot this guy would have sold this car.
Well, also, my bone with Facebook is, why are you listing a car that was listed a year ago? Right? The chances of this thing still being for sale are almost minuscule. So when I look at these pictures in Facebook and anything that's older than a month, I don't even bother with, because obviously what that tells me, Tommy, is that even if people had gone and looked at it for whatever reason, they didn't buy it. So if the thing, like you said, is festering on the vine, there's got to be something wrong with it.
I agree.
So let's go to the next one. This is another picture one. Cole, show that one, the $23,000 1972 Corvette. This is exactly what you don't want to do when you're selling a car. Now, this was listed 2 weeks ago in Pueblo, Tommy. I mean, I'm kind of interested in this car. So it's what you're seeing is basically the middle of the car for all of you who are listening to this as a podcast. And there's one picture. It's shot into the sun, and you don't see the front. You don't see the back. You just see the middle of the car.
But this guy also has three Zs, apparently, which we see there. No, it's a really good point, right? Make sure you can see the car from all angles so that a potential buyer has an idea whether or not the right side actually exists or whether or not has been scraped off by a pole. So, yeah, I think it's a really smart thing to include more than one image. I would do a minimum of Facebook of probably 8 pictures is kind of a sweet spot. I think there's a limit on how many you can actually post. But get good shots of the front three quarters. That's kind of the money shot.
The front three quarter is the one you want.
from both sides.
And don't shoot it into the sun, and don't shoot it vertically.
The rear three quarters, which you definitely want. A nice wide shot of the interior, a nice wide shot of the engine, and then a tight shot of the odometer, and ideally a VIN, if you're comfortable with that. That is kind of what I look for in a good posting.
Yeah, and I think if you're like us and you buy a lot of cars, you go to sites like Bring a Trailer or Cars and Bids, and there you will have literally hundreds of pictures of cars, of everything. We're not asking for that kind of detail, but we're certainly asking for more than one picture. Let's see the description, Cole. Let's see what he says about the car, or she says about the car.
C3, all original, matching number, saddle brown interior, automatic trans, 350 T-tops. This is the last year for front and rear. The chrome bumpers, tilt wheel, air conditioning, runs great. Listed below actual value, so you get a great deal for your investment and an awesome car to enjoy.
Yeah, but I don't see any of that. I mean, I read the words, but... You know, he says, excellent condition. Don't have a clue if that's true or not. And this car is being sold in Pueblo, which is from here about 3.5 hours. So I will not be driving down to Pueblo based on this ad. And if this car is truly what the seller is, it might be a, you know, a gem in the rough, but I can't tell. So it's not going to get looked at any more than we just did.
So one tip I have beyond just the good pictures, let's move on to the about the vehicle section, right?
Yeah.
So clearly this car has probably, unless it's the highest mileage C3 I've seen in a while, it says it's been driven 480,000 miles. So if you're going to put the mileage in the description, try to get the right number of zeros. I see this a lot, where likely this person means 48,000 miles, they add another zero. So I have no idea what the actual mileage is, but it's probably not 480,000. And then, you know, this guy did do a good job of doing automatic transmission, exterior color, fuel type. That's all very good.
I think you have to fill that in. I think those are...
And clean title. Yeah. But you'd be shocked by the number of times I've seen that stuff wrong.
All right, let's go back to the other one. And also, we may be in a car category here, C3 Corvettes, that lend themselves to older, maybe non-technical people. Cole, let's look at the red one. The $20,000 1972, that one, yeah. So this is another example of, like, if you can't even bother to pull the cover off completely. So what we're looking at is, once again, a half a Corvette, because the cover has only been pulled off half. And what I'm seeing, I like, but I immediately, oh, look at that interior. You could at least clean it off. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just, oh, my God. So now we're looking at a brown, like a baby puke brown interior on this car, which is very sad.
It's not that bad.
You don't think it's that bad?
No, it's very 70s. It's period correct. Yeah, it's fine.
I mean, the problem with
it... Well, there you go. He took the cover off that side.
Yeah, but he only got, like... This is a weird picture where what we're seeing is the front fender and the engine is sideways here, I think.
So, okay. So I think we've gotten the picture part established. Yeah. So what are some other... things that people should do or not do when posting a car.
All right, I'll give you another one. Go back, Cole. So let's look at this main page now. You see the one for 13,000, the red one there, where it says Wolf on it. So that's one ad that where this car is for 13,000. You included a video, 1978 Chevy Corvette, which is nice. Now go back, Cole, and scroll down a little bit, and then you'll see that this one has been posted twice. There it is again. This time
12.5.
So to me, if you post a car 12 times, and once it's for 13, once it's for 12.5, the idea is maybe you lower the price, but you can do that without reposting it, and it just feels desperate.
Well, they're trying to get more eyeballs on it.
Yeah, it just feels desperate to me.
One of the listings says Corvette Stingray. The other one just says Chevrolet Corvette. I think that it's a common tactic on Facebook. It's a little bit annoying, but if you are going to post your car more than once, at least keep the pricing consistent across the vehicles. And I do like how this person, the pictures are actually very good on this car, and I also like that they included a running video. That's also a really nice thing, so I can see how it runs, and that's good. That's just more transparency that a buyer needs.
Yeah, and my issue with the running video is everybody shoots it vertically.
I think you have to on Facebook. Because if you go horizontally...
The pictures are horizontal.
Go to the pictures. They're like a square, aren't they? Yeah, they're a square. I think if you post a video on Facebook, it goes like a weird little like letterbox thing. But I could be wrong.
I don't know. I mean, cars are horizontal. They're not vertical. So I like this. Now we're looking at pictures that are up close of the headlights. And we're seeing that there's a lot of like obvious damage.
Yeah, which is good.
And
so that
road
was
rash.
That was documented. Same thing with the bumper. So this person's actually done a pretty good job listing this. I think it's good to see the imperfections and some of the features. Overall, we got some wides, we got some tights. It's not a perfect listing, but it's pretty good.
Now, I don't like when the description kind of threatens the buyer. And what I mean by that is, if you read the end of the description, he says, one of a kind, call, hidden information. I have it on consignment, first come, first serve. Kind of trying to tell me, you know, you better come by before somebody else buys it. And that immediately turns me off because it's obviously first come, first serve. You don't need to tell me that. And by saying that, I feel like you're threatening me to buy it quickly before somebody else does.
Hmm. Okay. I think that like a lot of that you'll see on Facebook.
How about this one? Low baller, stay away, real offers only, might be facilitate shopping, getting divorced, need a settled price.
The problem is, like, there's so many scams on Facebook.
It just feels scammy.
No, the opposite. There's so many scams on Facebook, yeah. I think people feel the need to clarify, like, I don't want to be messed around with this.
True, yeah.
So I don't have a huge problem with that. This is kind of part of how it goes on Facebook. It's definitely the Wild West out there, right? I mean, my number one thing that I like to do is, so if I'm looking at this car, right? The first thing I'll do is I'll message the person and I won't say, hi, John, is this still available?
Right.
Because 9 times out of 10, it'll be ignored. But I'll say like a sincere message. Hey, I'm interested in your Corvette. I have a couple questions. I would like to learn. Do you mind giving me a call? And typically my rule is I won't go and take time out of my day to see the car unless I can talk to the person.
Yeah, I'm with you because you're really buying not the car, but the seller.
Well, yeah, to some extent.
Right. And if this, in our experience, and we've bought at this point, I don't know, maybe hundreds of cars, too many, right? And I've learned that if the seller is nice and, you know, polite and honest, then the car is all that. And if the seller is sketchy and kind of, you know, like doesn't want to answer your questions or can't call you back, then chances are the car has issues. So if I can't talk to the seller, I will not, like you said, take the time out of my day to go and look at the car. And we've done this so many times where we've been burned, where people said the car is one thing, and then like within 2 minutes of walking up to it, I know it's not the car that was advertised.
Sure. And that's just part of how it goes buying any car.
Yeah, true that.
Even talking to owners always have a different, you know, definition of what a perfect exterior looks like or an 8 out of 10 interior or what a scratch
let's,
is.
Let's talk about that. There are a lot of ads where they'll say, this car is in mint condition. It's been thoroughly kept up. It was always garaged. I've sorted everything. And then you look at the mileage and it says 225,000 miles. There's no such thing as a car in mint condition with 225. There is a car that can be in good condition, but with 225 miles, that car is used up.
I disagree.
I don't disagree because things that seem simple but are critical to the car start to go wrong at like that 100, depends on the era of car, right? But let's say from that 150 to 200 mile,
1,000
mile range, like really important, silly things that are very important start to break because the car has just been used up because it's that old. I'll give you an example, window regulators. It may seem like a small thing that the passenger window regulator dies, but I promise you in our Porsche, when my window regulator died, the first thing I did was go and immediately fix it because anytime you want to pull up to a Starbucks or anytime you need to talk to somebody and you can't roll down that window, it makes the car almost undrivable. And these things will start to go at that mileage. And if you're buying a four-door, that's four window regulators that are just going to time out because they're too old.
So the question is there, what's more important? Condition or mileage or both, right? So in my mind, in some cases, you are better off buying a high mileage car with a lot of receipts than a low mileage car that has never been maintained. And I'll give you an example.
Okay.
So we just bought this Mercedes E-Class.
Yes.
For $800.
Yes.
And we bought it from the donated auction. We figured out why it was donated because it had a bad radiator, right? But inspecting that car with our mechanic, Toby, he said this car is in better condition than 95% of cars we've ever bought. And it's got 542,000 miles. And we've brought him some fairly low mileage stuff, But this is a car that has been meticulously maintained. When the shocks went bad, the shocks were replaced. When the control arm bushings went bad, control arms were replaced. When a leak happened, leaks were replaced.
But the stuff that doesn't get replaced is the stuff that makes the car a pain in the ass. And I'll give you an example. You showed me that car, right? So the first thing I did was I opened that center console, and the whole center console came off in my hand.
Sure.
So it's that kind of stuff that doesn't get replaced. But when that kind of stuff breaks, it makes it so annoying for me that I don't want to own that car.
Yeah, but I would argue that that would happen at 80,000 miles as well. It's just an old car. It's a 23-year-old car. So if that car had 40,000 miles, or if it had 549,000 miles. And I'll give you an example.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
A buddy of mine, really interesting guy. He's got he paid, I think, well over $20,000 for the nicest E-Class Mercedes W210 in the world. It was a turbo diesel. It was like a 2001. So same exact era that we did. And he had to dump money into a car that had under 10,000 miles because it had been sitting and had it got old and stuff went bad.
Yeah, we had to dump money into a car that had also been taken care of.
Yeah, my point is I'd rather have the high mileage car that's been loved versus a low mileage car that had been sitting around and things left to deteriorate.
All right, so let's talk about what Toby is billing us. Mm-hmm. So the car was $800. Mm-hmm. It needed a new radiator. How much was that?
So that was $800.
So somebody didn't bother to fix a radiator. So.
Well, and I think what happened, if I had to take a guess, the reason the car was donated is because the radiator blew out.
We're hoping, because the transmission might be gone too.
Yeah, it could be. And there are wear items for sure.
And how about the rear brake calipers? How much are those?
No, it was the rear brake lines.
How much?
That wasn't miles. That was age.
Okay. But I'm saying...
That 10,000 mile E-Class had to have rear brake lines too because it had been sitting for 25 years.
The problem is I think the bill is going to be like $1,500 on an $800 car. And of course, you may be wondering, why are we doing that? Most people wouldn't spend more on a car that's going to be worth $800 after you put $1,500 into it. And the reason is because it's got over 500,000 miles and it's an interesting video. So we're kind of really in a weird position where we make money by making interesting videos, and a 500,000 mile Mercedes is an interesting car. So from a business standpoint, it's worth dumping more money than the car is worth into it. But most people won't do that.
And you're right. That certainly is an equation you have to work with in your head, is like, okay, this car is never going to be that valuable. How much do I want to put into it? Versus the super low mileage E-Class diesel is always going to have some value.
And then to me, the way I connect with a car is through the touch points and cars that are used up. Let's say they've been mechanically sorted. So 200,000 mile car where, you know, all the mechanical bits have been sorted. Chances are the parts I touch have not been sorted. So on that Mercedes is a good example. The steering wheel is definitely used up and I hate holding on to it because it's all sticky and weird because all of the like leather's coming off and I haven't sat in that car yet. But I bet you that seat is completely used up too.
It's not, actually. It's pretty good.
Even the springs?
Yeah, it's actually pretty good.
I won't sink into the floor when I sit on it.
No, I thought it was fine. Look, and those things are replaceable, right? And
yeah, but they're expensive to replace.
A steering wheel for an E320 from 1998, they built like a million of those cars. You can get those pretty easily.
Yeah, but my time is worth more than having to go to a junkyard and scrounge around and find the right steering wheel for that car, because that's the way the value of that car necessitates you doing that, because you could easily spend $400 on eBay for that steering wheel when you have an $800 car.
In my mind, I doubt it would be that much. I think it'd probably be $100 to $200. In my mind, I would much rather have, because you talk about buying the owner, right?
Right.
And that's what you're doing. In my mind, you are much better off buying the owner, who's someone that meticulously maintained that car over a long time, versus buying a nice car from an owner that didn't do that. And a good example of this is that Trans Am we bought. So we bought this really rare Trans Am CompTIA, if you remember, right?
I remember, yeah.
Super low mileage for the year. Yep. It's like, I don't know, 70,000 miles.
Yeah.
And it was aesthetically perfect. The paint was nice. The panels were nice. All the touch points were good. But the previous owners had not bothered to do the mechanical work. So when the window regulators broke, they didn't fix it. So we had a car that didn't have windows. When the LT1 started to get tired and OptiSpark started to go bad, they didn't fix it. So the car never was making the full power it should have been making. You can see there, So it was a nice car, visually really good. The touch points were good. It had a low miles, low owner, but it wasn't a very good car and it needed a lot of love to bring back to life.
Yeah, so my point, Tommy, at the end of the day is there's no such thing as a $200,000 Mint car.
A mile.
Mile, 200,000 mile Mint car. And the reason for that is it's just used up. All the parts are, you know, used up on it. Somebody has taken the life out of that car. And in most cases, in 99% of the cases, unlike this weird Mercedes we just bought, the cost of actually making that car would be much more than buying one that has a lot fewer miles. You see the problem. So yeah, you can buy a 200,000-mile car, but on paper, that car is worth nothing. And so you could spend $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 making it perfect, or you could just go buy one that's got 10,000 miles that is perfect for the same amount of money, right? Less miles, especially in collector car world, means more money.
But I would argue that 10,000-mile car is not going to be perfect. You're still going to be dumping money into
it. But it'll be worth a lot more.
Yeah, you might get it back on the return, but
That's why those wrapper cars, right? I hate that. I hate when people... I think it's absolutely silly if you buy a car that has low miles and then you're afraid to drive it. To me, cars are meant to be driven and they're fun and they're cool. And if you're buying a car because it's an investment or because, you know, a wrapper car where it's still in the wrapper, that is a whole different world that I don't know anything about because they're usually very expensive.
Well, we do actually. We had a wrapper car.
What do we have?
So we had this 84 Honda Civic station wagon that Honda sent us.
We didn't have it. It was Honda's
car. So the
car.
Honda sent it to us with 65 miles on it.
Yes.
And getting it running. And that car was a mess. It was a mess to get running. It was visually pristine. It was such a cool story. But our mechanic, Andy, had probably 100 hours in that car because as things sit, they deteriorate. That carburetor was completely clogged up. It had to be rebuilt. And every time we rebuilt it, when it got hot, more gunk would clog it up again.
But the value of the car was always there.
Sure,
because
I agree.
Because it had 64 miles on it.
Yeah, for sure.
And people would buy that car and they would fight to buy that car.
Right.
Because it's a time capsule. It reminds them of their youth. I mean, look at the interior in this thing. It's absolutely pristine.
If you care about value, that's important.
That is Mint to me.
I don't think it is Mint.
Okay.
I think it's Mint visually.
We can agree to disagree.
But that car needed a lot of love. It needed a lot of love. And then that needed brakes. It needed brake lines because it was all seized, right?
But
it was all old.
But if that car was 100,000 miles, right, mm-hmm. It would be worth, I don't know if it was running, it would be worth $400-$500. But because that car is 64 miles, I don't know what the real value is, but I bet you somebody would easily pay, you know, thousands for that car.
Yeah, probably 40, 50 grand.
And so then you can put that money into it and you can feel like you're getting something back out of it. Plus, you feel like you're driving, you know, a genuine time capsule that has not been mucked with. And that, to me, has value.
But I feel like you're attaching the value and the mintness of the car to the dollar amount, right? Just because a car has high mileage doesn't mean it can't be mint.
It's not mint. It's used up. It's just used
this
up.
This is the ship of Theseus discussion we had. I think it's Theseus.
Right. Well, if you repair the entire...
If you replace every part, is it the same car? Right? If you restore, Matt Farah's Million Mile Lexus just got restored, fully restored.
Yeah.
Is that a mint car? Right? Ship of Theseus. If you replace every board on that ship, at what point is it no longer the same ship?
But the problem is with cars, every board isn't going to get replaced.
Well, I disagree. I mean,
there'll be a lot of parts that will not get replaced.
Some of those boards don't need to be replaced, though.
Some of them do, and they won't get replaced.
Yeah, but my point is you can definitely have a high-mileage car.
All right, let's not bicker.
I think it's an interesting conversation, though, because a lot of people out there have high-mileage cars. If you keep it up and if you maintain it, I still think that car can be mint. I think that's very rare. I think the 90% of the Corvettes we've been looking at Facebook are not mint and have not been maintained to the high standard. But just because a car has high mileage doesn't mean that it's not going to be a good car.
And the other problem, Tommy, is you're living in this world where you think that you know, a 200,000-mile car has been meticulously
maintained, and most of them haven't.
People have replaced stuff before. A 200,000-mile car is just one brake away from going to the junkyard, and that brake will happen.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. And most people don't follow what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
but I'm saying it is possible. There is that small subset of people that love and treasure that car, money to no object, like this Mercedes we bought. This guy brought it into the Mercedes dealership for a starter motor at 418,000 miles.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? There's no financial benefit in doing that. You're paying top dollar for a car worth nothing.
That's why we bought it, because it was loved and it was maintained. So let's keep going. So here's another conversation we can have, like knowing what the value of your car is when you're posting it. So look at this $30,000 Corvette there, 1973 Chevy Corvette. Now, I may be out of my depth here because I don't know these C3s that well. So this is it's a blue Corvette. It's got white stripes on it. It's a 73. It's got that kind of cool rack on the back. It looks really clean, driven 58,000 miles. It's got the manual transmission, which always carries a premium.
This is another point that Bring a Trailer talks about a lot.
Yeah.
Just because it says it's 58,000 miles, especially with these five-digit odometers.
True that, yeah.
True mileage unknown unless you have rigid documentation to prove this thing hasn't rolled over.
So it says it has matching number L48350 engine and four-speed manual transmission. Has one repaint of the original color, which is great. The car runs and drives great.
I don't think the repaint's good.
Okay. Yeah, the interior looks good.
I've had nothing but bad news with repaints, but keep going.
You know, you're right. I mean, yeah, repaints. Oh God, there's so many levels of repaint. You know what I mean?
Right.
It could be anywhere from the rattle can to
the Mako to a $20,000 job. Yeah. I mean, there's so much unknown.
Hey, can you click see more there for? This is interesting. He's looking to trade it for such things as excavation equipment, classic Harley, or gold, Tommy. He's looking for gold.
Nice.
So if you have $30,000 worth of gold, you could trade it. Gold is going through the roof right now.
No, I mean,
So he's asking for $30,000.
Right.
If you look at all the other Corvettes, C3s that are standard, that car, in my mind, is a $15,000 car.
So
unless there's something and I don't know Corvettes, there could be something unusual, but I don't think it is. So the way I check the value of the car is I do a search on Hagerty, right? Hagerty insurance, when somebody goes and insures their car with them, mm-hmm. they find out how much that car was sold for. So they have thousands, tens of hundreds of thousands of cars that they insure. So they have a really good idea what the value of that car is. So let's see what Hagerty says a 1973 base Corvette is worth.
Well, hang on. It's not a base Corvette, though.
Okay.
And this is what's important to realize, uh-huh. is especially with these early C3s.
Yes.
Numbers like L48, LS4, L82.
Yeah.
Or in some cases.
Like I said, this is where I'm out of my depth.
If you get a really special engine in a car.
Right.
It can be the difference from $30,000, $50,000, or $1 million.
Yeah.
Right? If you get a really special one. So the closest one I could find was actually the 72 with that same L48 engine. You can see is worth about 23.
So the guy, according to Hagerty, he's $7,000 off.
But that's in good condition, and Hagerty has four different condition levels.
That car was good. That was I know good when I see good.
Well, usually it's not good. It's usually fair. Because Hagerty's good condition is actually pretty hard to meet.
Yeah.
And you can see, like, look at this. So there's a bunch of other...
Click the little question mark by good condition. It'll describe what that means.
Runs and drives well, flaws, not noticeable to passerbys, most common condition. So, okay, let's see this is a good condition car.
Yeah.
Now go back to the picture, Cole, on that 73. There's also some adjustments. Is it a manual transmission? It is. So then go back to Hagerty. So it was a $22,000 car. If it's a close ratio manual, then we're looking at plus $1,000, right?
Yeah.
Plus $200 for power windows, plus $2,000 for AC on all others. So there are some value changes that would adjust the price of this car. If you scroll down, Cole, if it was just a standard four-speed, sometimes they have like...
$15,000. We looked at it.
Look, this is a good example. So especially with these Corvettes, they have 10,000 sales data, right? The most recent sale was for $26,000. The lowest sale was for $400, and the highest sale was for $3.1 million.
Sure.
And this is all within that C3 Corvette.
Yeah, 68 to 82.
Right. So it's really important that when I'm pricing a car, I go on to plus something like Hagerty, or I find very close comps. Because in the classic car world, an alphanumeric three-digit number could be the difference from $15,000 to $1 million.
All right. Well, let's go back. Let me show you another car. We're talking about like the difference of cars. Go back. Keep going back one more, Cole, and I'll show you a good example of that. Let me go up, scroll up a little bit, Cole, please. Is that the up? Okay, scroll down, scroll down, scroll down, scroll down, scroll down. No, 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 no. Huh, the car's not there anymore. It was there yesterday when I was getting ready for this podcast.
Maybe it's sold.
I don't think so. It's been there for like 3 months.
All right. Well, it's not there now.
It could because could you go up again? Let's see. It was at the very top last time. No.
All right. What can you describe? what you're talking about?
No, because I need to show it. It's weird. Scroll down again. It's weird that it's not there.
Can I talk about something else while you're looking
for it? Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
So when I sold my Super Beetle, I used Haggerty and I used other comps to kind of choose a fair value for that car.
Yeah.
And like Beetles are another one where the prices are just all over the board, right? So what I did was I found three or four comps in my area and I kind of priced it right in the middle of those comps relative to what Haggerty said, make sure it was still in that ballpark. And then the market was pretty soft for Beetles when I sold mine. So I ultimately lowered the price for a quicker sale. So that's, in my opinion, that's the two quickest ways to sell a car on Facebook are good pictures and then fair pricing, right? If you want a car to sell fast, you just lower the price. Even by a couple $100s can have a big impact. And I usually will price a car like that 1990 there. Instead of pricing it for 10 grand, I'll do what this person did, where I'll price it for 9,990, that white Corvette there. So that's a great way I find to kind of just play some of those little mental games, right, and help people move cars on. So that's something that I found to be really successful.
Hey, Cole, can you do a search for a 1970 Corvette? I think it was a 1970 Corvette. I was just looking for it.
This is the problem with Facebook.
It changes, yeah. It just changes what you're seeing. There it is, see? Okay, click on the silver car, and it didn't show it to us last time, that car. Mm-hmm. So that's a 1970 Corvette for $49,000.
Yep.
Which seems to be really expensive, even for a pre. And then another thing to keep in mind, in places like, I think this is also in California, places like Colorado, Corvettes, any car that's pre-1976 carries a premium because it doesn't have to meet emissions.
Sure. This is actually a good deal on this car.
So why is this one $49,000?
Because this is an LT1 car.
Okay.
It's numbers matching LT1. And LT1 was a fairly rare option for a high compression, high powered 350 small block. So you had the big block cars, and then Chevrolet introduced this pretty low take rate for this option, which was a 350 small block, but with high compression in the engine more horsepower.
How much? So it had less than the 427.
I think it had pretty much the same horsepower as the big block car, but it was much smaller and lighter. So this is a real enthusiast choice, and you can also see that this person knows that, and they listed power brakes, power windows, tilt steering, which were all options that can add value to the car. So this is actually not a bad deal. So while we were looking at other comps for 70s that might be 20, 25, this one at 49 is not a bad deal because of that LT1 engine.
Well, let's see what Haggerty says, Cole. Why don't you punch in 1970 LT1.
Just do 1970 Corvette, and we'll see what the price spread is.
Okay, let's see.
Yeah. Okay, so we can see an L46 car is worth 36, and an LT1 car like that one is worth 43, and a base one is worth 30. So that's 43.8.
In good condition.
Plus 1800 if it's the close ratio, which I think this one is. I think it had power windows, and I think it also had AC.
Let's go back. Let's see if it had AC.
Go to the
power windows for sure.
Power windows, power brakes.
Mileage may be original. That's so it's got 72,000.
Go to the interior or the engine pictures. Let's see if we see an AC compressor on that engine.
I don't see an AC compressor.
Can't see one. Go to the interior, Cole. Is there an interior pick? Okay. So look, he's not that far off. But my point is that even at 43 or 44, he's asking 49. You could probably negotiate him down to that Haggerty value.
And usually, either for Facebook and for Craigslist, my rule of thumb on that is if you're going to price your car and you want to sell it, price it at the fair price and add like 10% to it because be ready to drop it by 10%. And I think that is a normal. So if a car is 50,000, really you should be ready to drop it to 45,000.
Sure.
That's just a basic rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And if a car is 10,000, be ready to drop it by 1,000.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's a good way to look at it.
Should we talk about some other stuff?
Yeah. Did we go through it?
I think we got it all pretty much. Yep.
Yeah. So pictures.
Pictures. Good description.
Description.
Keep it accurate. Right. Mileage.
Get the right price. Take it down if it hasn't sold or lower the price. I wouldn't do multiple postings. I think that makes you look desperate.
Talk to people on the phone.
Yeah.
Meet in public places. The usual safety bits. Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that that pretty much covers the gamut.
One other thing I want to talk about, and this is like a cliche that people always use, and that is go get a pre-purchase inspection. And in real life, I think that is so hard to do, Tommy, because the problem with the pre-purchase inspection is not just the logistics of it, is that the seller has no motivation, basically, to allow you to do that.
Well, they have the motivation because they think you're going to buy it. That kind of shows you're a serious buyer.
But it also shows him that, and especially with old cars, right? Like this Corvette he's described, this 1970 Chevy LT1, he's described it as in being really great condition. I promise you, if I take that car to a mechanic, mm-hmm. I can find $20,000 worth of repairs on that like that.
Sure.
Right? And so the seller knows that, and then I'm going to come back to him as a buyer, and I'm going to be like, hey, I took it to my mechanic, and he said that it needs this, 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 and this. So are you willing to lower it $20,000? And then you're in this weird position.
Well, then you say no. That's the end of the weird position.
But no, it is a weird position because now, you know, I've spent a lot of time and money, right, getting that, and then the buyer's like, no, go jump in a lake. I get that it's got some issues, but I don't necessarily value those issues because the price of the car is what somebody else is willing to pay for.
Well, then you say no and you go to the next one.
You just spent a lot of time and money. And then if I'm the seller of that car, I know this guy's going to try to bank me over the head with that, you know, pre-purchase inspection. So what's my motivation for doing it?
Well, so you say it needs $20,000 worth of work.
Yeah.
Would you take $5,000 off the sticker? And that likely they would be reasonable and say, yeah, that's what happens a lot of the time, right?
I hope you're right because a lot of the time the kind of people who do that aren't going to be like, would you take $5,000? They'll be like, would you take $15,000 off the sticker?
Well, and then you say no. So Facebook is there's a lot of sharks in that sea. There's a lot of fish in the sea.
And then the other problem with that pre-purchase inspection is I actually called this guy mm-hmm. because I was interested in this car. And he said that because it's winter, he's turned off his insurance mm-hmm. And he can't really even drive it. So look, you're looking for a car that's very hard to find, right? These are not common. So all of a sudden, the insurance is, so he's also worried about it because it's his baby. So sure. You're going to say, I'm going to take it, drive it to a next town over, give it to my mechanic. And he's like, hey, my insurance isn't even on this thing. So
what if you pay a mechanic to come with you?
Yeah, that's a possibility.
So that's another option too, where maybe you don't get as thorough of an inspection. Maybe you don't have the access to a lift, but you can certainly get a good sense of what's good on it, what's bad on it.
Like I say, to me, you make very good points. But buying a car, the reality of buying a car is much different, right? You make it sound like it's this very clean transaction where, half the time, especially on Facebook, more than half the time, Tommy, I can't even get the seller to call me back.
Sure.
Let alone bring a mechanic for a pre-purchase inspection, right?
Yeah.
And that's why dealers do so well, because dealers understand the way that cars are purchased. And it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of effort and energy to buy a good car from a private individual, whereas you can just go to the dealer and have your temporary plate in Colorado given to you, you know, have your financing done at the dealership and walk out with a new car, whereas I got to deal with some guy who's turned the insurance off on his car, and then I got to get my mechanic, and then, you know, I got to negotiate for the price. And I think all that just leads to people buying cars from dealers.
It also saves you money because a dealer is going to be 15% more.
Or the other thing people do is they buy their cars off of online auctions because, once again, you know, a lot of those online auctions do this for you, at least in terms of the pictures and in terms of the description.
But look, the fact of the matter is, and in my opinion, an online auction is a terrifying prospect.
Oh, I'm with you, absolutely.
Because that's even forget the pre-purchase inspection. A lot of online auctions, you never even have, most of them you don't have a chance to even see the car in person. And then you the car shows up and you realize the right rear window doesn't work and the tachometer has been rolled over. I mean, there's so many things you can do.
People don't talk about the dark side of online auctions.
Right.
Like, okay, so let's say you're not even a dishonest seller. You're just a typical seller and you don't disclose these things.
Dishonest.
Okay. You don't disclose these problems or you don't think they're important. I want to give the person benefit of the doubt. And then you buy this car. It's across the country, which most of them are. Very rarely are they in your neighborhood, right? And then you pay to have the car delivered. It shows up and the rear window switch doesn't work and the air conditioning is on and off. And then you call the auction company and you say, hey, this guy sold me, you know, a car that is not as described. What's the auction company going to do? They're going to ban the seller. That's all they're going to do.
Look, it's buyer beware. Right. Yeah,
exactly.
So it's always a little bit of a gamble when you're dealing with auctions.
I think it's a huge gamble in my mind.
I mean, it depends.
Okay, we bought our Jeep. from, to be fair, we bought our classic World War II Jeep from a really great seller.
Yeah, and it was perfect.
It was perfect.
Exactly as advertised.
It was exactly as advertised. The guy was wonderful, and I wish that everybody had that experience. But for me, you're rolling the dice when you're doing an online auction. So I will, I will rather go through all the work that we just described so that I can get hands-on and I can get a sense for the car myself. And I've bought some stinkers, but for the most part, then it's on me, and I have nothing... nobody to blame but myself, because I looked at the car, I drove the car, and I still bought the car.
But you have to keep in mind, too.
You know that old Camaro we bought, right? We never saw that car. We bought it sight unseen, basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a real...
Well, yeah, but the thing is, like, some cars, you just can't go on Facebook and buy. So if you want a C3 Corvette, anywhere you are in the country, you'll have 25 listings in your area.
Yeah, for sure.
If you want a restored World War II Jeep...
Yeah.
Where are you going to go to get it, right?
Well, I mean, obviously, a great place to buy that is you join the Model T community or the World War II Jeep community, and a lot of those cars trade hands.
Talk about a lot of work. Then you have to build trust with people. You have to find the right person. And if someone's not selling, you have to convince them to sell, or maybe it's selling, but it's not the right one. I mean, that can be a year-long process, right?
But it's a rare car, and if you want exactly the right one...
not that rare. World War, 600,000 of them were made.
But I'm saying a lot of those cars never see auctions or Facebook Marketplace. Sure. They're sold among...
That's a great situation, yeah. But that's a tough road to go down. Yeah, that's a tough road.
Yeah.
And especially if it's something like a Model T, right, where... You could join a local club and then see if anyone's selling, and then no one sells until they die, and then they die.
The great thing about a Model T is that they're that simple that there isn't, you know, it's hard to hide fault. I mean, there's like four things that can go wrong with it, and those things are pretty easy to see, right?
Yeah.
The engine is so basic. The transmission is so basic.
Yeah, but there's still stuff you can hide.
Yeah, but I mean, not like a modern car where, you know, there's so much
that's
more.
That's not that modern.
But you know what I'm saying? There's so much more that can be, like there's no window regulators in a Model T.
Right.
There's no air conditioning, air conditioning compressor. There's no power brake. Right, there's none of that.
But there's a shocking amount of stuff that can go bad in a Model T that you can hide. Like rear differential problems are very, very common. Or what's the condition of the bands in the transmission? You need to reband, and then you've got your Babbitt bearing. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that can go wrong on a T.
I think you're overcomplicating it, but fair. You're the Model T expert.
Now, should we move on? I think we've beat this one pretty good.
Yeah, so guys, let us know in the comments below maybe any experiences that you've had buying cars online. Or from Facebook Marketplace or at the auction, and let us know if they've been good or bad. I'm really curious. I can only kind of, you know, this is a very tainted conversation because I can only go by what I've done personally.
All right, let's talk about what we've been up to this week. So I was just in San Francisco driving a bunch of Cadillacs. So I drove the new Cadillac Optic.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Which is the new baby EV Cadillac SUV. And then I drove the new Cadillac Escalade IQ, which is their full-sized $130,000 monster of a vehicle. So Cole and I were out in San Francisco having some fun in the sun. And this was a big surprise. I really like this little Optic.
Is it based on any other GM platform, EV platforms?
So it's based on the Equinox EV.
That's what I thought.
Which is the small crossover.
Yeah.
But I was pleasantly surprised that they went through a huge amount of effort to not just make it feel like a rebadged 1980 Cimarron. So that they actually, the days of old GM where they would change the headlights and the emblem and add some more velour to the interior are gone.
Okay.
This thing feels like a bespoke product, which I was super surprised with. It was the biggest differentiation between a Chevrolet counterpart I've seen. So
I like the design.
Pretty good value,
modern,
too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
how much does it cost?
So $54,000 is the starting. This one was fully loaded. It was about $60,000, which is a lot of money.
Once again, feels $10,000 too expensive, but okay.
Yeah, but hold your horses there. Yeah. So this competes with the Model Y. Comes standard with Super Cruise, right? So really it competes with the Model Y long-range all-wheel drive with full self-driving.
I'm feeling like for $60,000 you can get a Lyriq.
That's going to be $57,000. And the Lyriq's a little bit more.
Is it?
Yeah. Okay. So comparable Model Y with full self-driving is going to be $57,000. This is $60,000. Then you start adding some colors and stuff on Model Y, and you're pretty much there, right? This car has heated, ventilated, and massage seating, which is very good. It's got physical controls on the interior for important stuff, which I thought was excellent. It's got all sorts of funky and fresh materials. The build quality felt excellent. It has the Google interface on the screen with Google route planning, which I haven't experienced, where you can say, I'm in California, I want to go to Boulder. It will Google, not Cadillac, Google will tell you where to stop and for how long to stop. super, super, super well integrated with the car. It's got real stocks. It was very, very comfortable in the interior. So I think they did so much.
I like the
design
of it. It looks very clean.
Yeah, 302 miles of range.
I like when they put, actually, I like when they put this like very long elastic fabric on the dashboard like it has. It feels Swedish in some ways.
And believe it or not, this is about the same price and in some cases cheaper than the fully loaded Equinox. Hmm. Like if you get the top of the line RS Equinox, they're like 58 grand.
You know, with Tesla being boycotted and sales plummeting, and Model Ys and Model 3s just stacking up at their stores, I was thinking about this. I'm like, who benefits from that? And then I was walking the dog today, and I saw a brand new Volkswagen ID 4.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that, you know, people are buying these cars. In much of the world, electric car sales are up. You know, the death of the electric car has been prematurely forecasted. And so I think cars like this are going to benefit from, you know, from the fact that people now, a lot of people now think Tesla is toxic. And so maybe the death of the electric car, like I said, has been overblown.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that this is a really good option. And what we're finding now is, especially with the access to the supercharger network that GM, Ford, and all these other companies are rolling out, that the Tesla advantage is kind of slipping considerably. I mean, there are some things that this Optic doesn't do very well, like the charging time.
You know what the real head scratcher is, Tommy? Sorry.
Charging time is not very good. Like it's 150 kilowatt AC, or DC charging versus 250 plus for some of the competition.
You know what the real head scratcher is?
What?
Why Tesla opened up their network to competitors? Because that to me was their biggest advantage.
Well, I think that make them a lot of money.
You think?
I mean, how much, what do you think it cost GM to charge a Tesla networks?
Don't know.
So, I mean, there could have been a lot of money changing hands there. And then you've got the future GM buyers that are going to be spending money at Tesla chargers. So maybe there's more money in it than we think there is.
Or maybe they gave up a huge advantage that they're now regretting that they don't have anymore because, you know, the reason I would buy that, if Tesla wasn't in, you know, the situation it's in right now, over a Model Y is because of the Tesla charging network. And now with a lot of companies having access to it, I'd be like, I'll just get that.
There's still some things Tesla does better.
Yeah.
Range on this car is 302.
Okay.
It's got like an 85 kilowatt hour battery. I think it's 85 kilowatt hours. And then the there's no front trunk, which is still dumb, right?
Yeah.
So there's some packaging things which aren't very good. But as a whole, it's an amazing product. By the way, I've been really enjoying driving the Model S around. We have this 2014 Model S we bought for 13 grand, 100,000 miles, and it has been an amazing car to drive around in.
Yeah, even an 11-year-old Tesla is still a very good car. And it's funny because we bought it for $13,000 before the, you know what, hit the fan with Tesla.
Yeah.
And Tesla prices, I was looking across the board, are down 15% right now. Mm. And yet that car with 100,000 miles still has at least, what, 200-ish miles of range? We'll do a range test on it.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think even in the winter, so Recurrent, our charging analytics sponsor, monitors hundreds and thousands of cars, right? And they have the data on how various models do in degradation over time. Our car's right where it's supposed to be. It was sold new with 265. According to Recurrent, we're down to like 235. So we've lost about 30 miles of range. But that's over 11 years and 100,000 miles. And it says in the next 3 years, Recurrent says we're supposed to be getting about 231. So we've kind of plateaued on the degradation on the battery. And realistically, I've been experiencing about 200 in the winter.
I would say that is the biggest myth in the electric car world. And I don't know how you bust that myth, but let me bust it for you.
That you don't have to do that.
I'm going to bust it, Tommy. Oh, come on. Let me have fun. You're like, you should see the look if you're listening to this. Look at his face. It's like, I'm just worried
if you
oyster.
If you touch the mic.
Oh, it'll be fine. It's got the little cut.
Things get pretty
rough.
Nicole
is laughing over there. So here's a secret, Tommy. All right, I won't touch the mic. You're giving me that nasty
look.
Well,
I don't know much about audio equipment, but when I see Billie Eilish perform, she usually doesn't hold the mic cover thing.
Oh, now I'm right in front of my
face.
There you
go, okay.
And I can't see my face. That's not good either. The secret is electric cars are not like telephones. The battery does not die in 2 years. In fact, studies have shown, repeat that, Serious studies have shown that you lose 1% of an electric car's battery per year, which means a 10-year-old electric car is still going to have 90% of its battery. Mm-hmm. So let me repeat that, 1% a year. So don't freak out.
It's not really linear, though.
I'm just being,
but on average.
On average. And so, if you take the politics out of it, this is a great time to buy a used Tesla.
Sure.
I think if you live in San Francisco, that may be a hard thing to swallow because especially there, people driving Teslas are just getting a lot of crap. But if you're worried about, supporting the man versus the company, then a used Tesla is not going to give a lot of money to the company unless, I guess, you charge it on a supercharger and buy a lot of parts for it. But in general, we took our Model S to the Tesla store and found that it didn't need a lot of parts. I mean, the stuff it needed, we could have replaced. We didn't because
it needs about $2,500. I mean, it needs suspension. Suspension's pretty tired on that car. There's some clunks, like it needs control arms. And then the big concern about these early Model S's is the coolant actually getting into the motor. There's a design flaw with these cars where coolant can bypass a seal and then fry your motor. And then you do something called a coolant delete, which is something that's probably recommended.
You should probably do.
Yeah.
But we lucked out because ours had its motor changed.
Yeah, so, but when they replace the motor, they replace it with the same faulty motor.
Right. But it has been replaced.
Yes, but it's making a couple weird sounds.
Like what?
Like when you floor it,
The
motor goes.
All right, let us know if you're a Tesla tech, let us know what that means.
Yeah. So I think that it's probably fine, but there are like a couple weird groans coming out of the car every now and then. I'm not too worried about it because it is such an affordable car. But as a machine, it's got great technology. In my opinion, the technology is pretty much on par with what you can find out of a new one.
For $2,500, you can update the computer.
Sure, but I don't really think you need to.
And then you get things like you can do YouTube and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't care about that.
Yeah.
It has dog mode already. It's got camp mode. It's got the amazing route planning.
And it's got free supercharging for life, which
yes, but it's very slow.
By the way, it stopped charging. I got a notification last night that it stopped charging at 54%.
Why did it do that?
I don't know.
I wonder what happened.
Yeah. The charger at the ranch has some issues.
So the supercharging speeds, apparently in 2019, Tesla kind of nerfed the charging speeds on the older cars. Software update, they went from 150 or 200 down to 60. So it does supercharge very slowly. And I think part of that is A, they want to keep these older Model S's on the road for a long time. And then B, I got stuck. And then B, they don't want people free supercharging for a long time because that costs them money. That's my personal theory, is that they nerfed charging speeds a little bit to save themselves some money.
Somebody set the charger down to 50%.
I don't know what happened there. It wasn't me.
Now it's charging again.
Okay.
I just moved it up. And that's also one of the things that Tesla does really well, which is the app.
Mm-hmm.
So it told you that it was, that it stopped charging and now it's starting to charge again.
Great.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So anyway, what else? You said you saw the new Cadillac. Tell me about that.
The Escalade IQ and IQL. So they have a new full-size electric Cadillac.
Yep.
The Escalade IQ is based on the Hummer EV platform, essentially. Pretty much the same team that did the Hummer, same team that did the Escalade IQ. And then the L is a slightly longer version. They don't actually change the wheelbase, but they do add space for the third row. It's 5 inches longer. Both of them are over 8,000 pounds. Both of them are absolutely insane, but they are very cool. I was kind of thinking they feel a lot like a rebranded Hummer, but the interiors are totally different. The design's totally different.
Would it be more like a rebranded Silverado EV, maybe?
No. Okay. They really gave it its own kind of character and own feel. So I was kind of blown away with what they did with this thing. It was really cool.
When's that video coming out?
IQL, I think, will go up on Monday.
Okay, there it is.
Yeah, there it is.
That's a handsome car.
That's the standard IQ. They look pretty much the same.
Yeah.
And there's not really that much difference in trunk space, but the IQL does have a square trunk versus a slant trunk that the standard IQ has.
Now, it's funny because you went on the program for journalists and yet the car is for sale already.
Yeah, so I can't talk about how it drives, but you could go drive one at your local Cadillac dealership right now and then tell me how it drives. So the embargoes are getting pretty nutso on these trips.
Yeah, you kind of put your finger on the problem from our point of view.
Yes, exactly. So you guys, if you want to tell me how it drives, feel free to drop a comment below.
We can't tell you until Monday.
But I can't tell you until like Monday or Tuesday, I think.
I'm guessing it's over 100.
Yeah, you can see it starts at 130 and then goes to 150. Yeah. But Cole and I had a great time. It has automatic closing doors. This is a new trend now. Have you seen these?
Not just soft close. You mean completely closing.
Yeah, remember
the Tesla Model X did.
Yes.
I love that. That was my favorite feature. We had a Tesla Model X, and when you got in it, all you had to do is press the brake, and then the door would automatically close.
But this one, you could do this in the X because it had the Falcon wings, but you could also open the rear doors on the screen. So if you have like a livery guest coming, you can slide the rear door open without getting out of the car.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is very cool. Yeah. So there's
I have to say, my favorite feature on the X was the fact that the door would close itself. It felt so luxurious and so like over the top that you didn't have to reach over and, you know, and it's completely silly, right? Because closing a door is the easiest thing in the world. But sometimes luxury is having people do the easiest thing in the world for you.
So it also has 55 inches of screen.
That's too much.
Yeah, it's too much. Yeah, this whole trend toward passenger screens, I just don't understand.
You know,
why not use a phone?
It's funny. So I've been reading the news, and finally, like the rest, because we kind of drive all of the newest cars. Obviously, it's our job, and so we kind of hit upon these trends early. And it takes a while for it to kind of percolate through the auto buying world. And people are now just starting to figure out that like, they hate the fact that a lot of the door handles are electronic and retractable because it causes so many issues. They hate the fact that every manufacturer has decided to move the way you shift the car into gear to either have a start button or not have a start button. And I think the general public is getting really tired of having to figure out how to drive a car all over again.
Well, what I'm finding is I'm just getting a lot, like within the last 2 weeks specifically, I'm getting a tremendous amount of technology fatigue. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I used to think of myself as a pretty tech savvy person, but getting in and out of these cars now, like, there's so many configurations and customization I can do. Like this Cadillac, we were driving the IQ.
No driving impressions.
I'm not telling you driving impressions. I wanted to change the center screen.
Yeah.
And I just I was so burnt out from dealing with the screens. I just gave up. I'm like, I'm just going to leave it like this because there's so many menus and submenus and buttons and switches. And like, why? This is at this point, it's not adding anything to my driving experience. It's actually retracting or subtracting from my experience. Like driving my 84 Mercedes that has none of it.
Yeah.
It's got buttons for climate control. It has a cassette deck and it has power windows. And driving this thing with 55 inches of screen, there is almost nothing I feel like I'm getting out of this experience. It's better than the Mercedes from getting me from point A to point B, except now I'm thinking three times as hard to make anything work.
Here's a thing that's also crazy dangerous, and I've actually hit upon this a lot. And people say, a lot of journalists say that we need to give manufacturers a break because most people, when they buy their car, they become familiar with it. And since we're driving a different car every week, you know, it's not that intuitive for us. But how about this one? I love how they keep hiding and moving the hazard switch. That's one of my biggest pet peeves. It's like, I'll need the hazard switch for something that's usually pretty immediate and pretty critical. And then I'll be like, I have no clue where they hid the damn thing.
So there is actually regulation on that.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
No, because they move it around so much.
They've had it forever, actually, the regulation. So the regulation, as far as I know, on hazard switches is it has to be a physical button.
Yeah.
So even in like a Tesla, it's a physical button. And it has to be located down the center line of the car. So you'll never find like a hazard switch on the far left of the steering column. You'll never find it like hidden in a menu. It has to be located down the middle portion of the car. It can be on the roof.
You know
it can be in the center console.
You know what the problem with that is?
What?
It's like that little arrow that tells you what side the gas cap is on. You know, the gas... gas receiver.
Gauge, or the gas filler.
So every car, I think almost every car, when you look at the gas gauge, there's a little arrow. It'll either point left or point right.
Yeah, Ford invented that in like the 80s.
Yeah, and that tells you on what side you fill the car up on, which is great because especially from our point of view, we drive a lot of cars. It's always like, which one do I pull into? Which gas station? Which side do I pull into? But the problem is, unless you know that, then it's useless information. Unless you know the fact that arrow is there. And it's like, you told me that it's in the center, I kept looking over everywhere because I didn't know that there was a rule that it has to be in the center of the
arrow,
car.
Arrow is very standard knowledge now.
I don't think so. I just had Mary who didn't know it.
But Morgan knew it, which I was pretty impressed with.
And do they do the same thing for electric cars?
Yeah.
They do the little
usually they do. Yeah, next
what
to the
if it's in the nose?
Well, listen, but Dad, here's the thing. This is a pretty uniquely us problem.
Because no, I disagree. I think it's a everybody problem.
So Morgan drives one car, and she doesn't often forget where the gas filler is because she drives the one car. Cole, do you often forget where it is on your RAV4? No, because if you drive one car all the time, you know it, right? It's a problem for us because we have 15 cars in the office and 3 press cars a week, and we're constantly in and out, and then we don't know.
So, Cole, you never drive your friend's car, you never rent a car.
Rental, sure.
But if she's not in the car. I agree. So Cole said if he drives his girlfriend's car, he'll just ask her.
Yeah. But the point is like, it is a problem, especially if you're renting a car, but it's such a small problem. I mean, the cool solution I think that we need to figure out a way to get back to is what they did in the 60s, except don't cause cars to blow up.
Put it behind the plate?
Yeah, put it in the middle.
Behind the license plate?
And then it doesn't matter what side you pull up
on. I thought that
was
so cool.
Well, it was very dangerous.
I know, but it was so cool because it's like a James Bond thing, right?
Yes.
The gas filler is hidden behind the plate.
But when you get rear-ended, it exposes a lot of fumes to a lot of sparks. That was really cool. And then I also thought what Jaguar did was really cool, where they had the boat tail with the 2 filler necks.
Yeah, you can go and you can go to either side.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And then I actually have to give this.
And we had a truck that had that too. Our old Ford. What was it?
That was a pain in the butt. No, the
Chevy had it. They had 2 tanks.
Yeah, but that was terrible.
And they were on the same side.
No, they were not.
Yeah, they were.
No, the Ford has 2 tanks on the same side.
And the Chevy had on either side.
Yeah, and the Chevy was dumb because you had to then fill up one tank, then drive around and fill up the other one. The Ford, at least they were both next to each other.
Well, you would have had that switch where you switch from tank to tank and working. And ours wasn't working, so it didn't really matter.
I actually think the Nissan solution is really good, and nobody does it anymore. But the Leaf has it in the nose. And then this whole supercharger, oh my gosh, I have to park weird because the supercharger cable's not long enough.
There's no doubt that charging ports, like the Rivian, should be in the nose. Because you pull up to a supercharger.
Sure.
And it just makes a lot of sense.
Well, I mean, you could argue that superchargers are meant for the rear left, right? So maybe it should be in the front left.
Well, think about this. Let's say you're even
front right.
Let's say you're even towing right now.
Yeah.
You have to have a pull-through charger.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're going to block every charger. Whereas if it were in the nose, the Cybertruck had it in the nose, you could potentially just pull up right up to it, and then the load, your trailer would be behind
blocking
you.
Blocking the whole road.
No, you wouldn't be. Usually things are like in parking lots, right?
So if you did that at the 29th Street Mall, you'd be blocking the whole road. Well, not in the mall,
but if it's a parking lot and there's nothing behind you, that might actually work.
Sure. I think that the nose charging is a really good idea.
Well, you know what's a good idea? Hey, manufacturers, get together and standardize it.
Yes, that should. But they haven't done that with fuel either, which is dumb. Although it's not dumb, actually.
No, because the fuel is based on what side of the road you drive on often.
Yeah.
And then the theory is like with the Germans, right? The Germans always do
the right.
The right, which is the
not. So if you run out of gas in Germany,
yes,
you're filling up on the right side out of traffic.
So you're not standing in traffic on the Autobahn getting run over by cars doing 150 kilometers.
But if you run out of gas in America, it's always on the left, and you are getting run over by 18 wheelers doing 85 miles an hour.
So put it behind the plate in the ass.
There you go. Remember, like in like the 50s cars, where they put it behind the taillight? That was really cool too.
Tesla does that.
No, not like they did in like a 57 Cadillac.
But this is kind of behind the taillight.
No, it's next to the taillight. Have you seen a 57 Cadillac?
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
The taillight actually folds down, and then the filler is behind the taillight.
I say bring back giant fins. Bring back the fin.
And impales children.
Bring back fin and giant booby bumpers.
Little Timmy on his bicycle.
That would be cool. Electric car with fins and those like booby bumpers.
They're not booby bumpers. They're the little rocket bumpers. Yeah.
That's what they said, but you know what they were thinking.
All right, folks.
Hey, before we go, you had how much time? How long have we gone? Okay, let's one more thing because it's interesting. You had an interesting conversation with a GM engineer when you were in California about the Camaro. Tell me what you found out. This is something that I found very interesting because I haven't heard this.
Yeah, super cool guy. Kind of one of the guys in charge of the 5th and the 6th generation Camaro. He'd been at GM for 40 some years. We had a long discussion about like kind of the development of those cars. And 5th gen Camaro was actually almost canceled. Because that was mid-development when the financial crisis happened, and then GM went into bankruptcy, and then the government came in, right, started running the show, And the government actually went to them and said, cancel Camaro. This is not a needed project when you're facing bankruptcy. And the team was so far in to that project, they said, we already spent nine figures. You want us to cancel it? And they allowed it to happen. So that car almost didn't happen. And at the same time, actually, he was saying they also had a Chevelle in development and all these other Pontiacs too.
But the most interesting part was, you know, Taj, right? Who just retired, who was
Taj,
who was the chief engineer of the
Corvette,
yeah. Right? There was a rivalry between Camaro and Corvette internally at GM.
Huge rivalry. Yeah, the Camaro and Corvette teams were largely different, and they had a great kind of almost brothership rivalry where they were constantly joshing each other to make their cars faster.
And the question that I've always wondered is, if the Camaro guys came out with a car that was quicker, let's say on the Nürburgring, than the Corvette, would GM allow them to do that? And you found out the answer to that.
So I guess on sixth generation, when they were doing ZL1-1LE, if I remember correctly, they set a Nürburgring record of like 122 in that car.
In the Camaro.
In the Camaro, which at the time was faster than the official record set by Corvette. I think this was C7 then. This engineer was with Mark Royce,
right,
who was Big Cheese at the time.
He's a Big Cheese.
And said, listen, Mark, we got more to go in this car. We can make this car faster, but like we're already faster than Corvette. Like, is this going to be a problem for the marketing? And Royce was like, no, go for it. Make this thing as fast as you possibly can.
That is so cool.
Or maybe it ran like, I think the official time was a 115 or 115, a 715.
That'd be really fast.
A 115 would be amazing. It was like a 715. And apparently on an unofficial record, they even got it faster afterwards, but they were able to eat more power to this thing, and they were not concerned at all about taking market share.
Yeah, because price-wise, of course, the Corvette lives.
Yeah, right. And there's like this perception that they can't make the Camaro too good or it'll take away sales from Corvette. But I got confirmation that never happened. It was always about making the best car.
Did you ask him why they built such a high belt line?
Yeah, I did not. No, I did not. But apparently they had plans for 7th Gen when it was canceled. And I couldn't squeeze out what those plans were. He wouldn't tell me. I presume it would have been an electric-based 7th Gen.
All right. Well, there you have it. You heard it first on the Fast Lane
Talk.
Car Chat.
Yes.
Podcast.
That's right. And as always, head over to alltfl.com where we got more discussions there.
Yeah, we'll see you next time. Ciao.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guaranteed details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.